The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. This program was originally broadcast live on 93.9 KPDQ. We hope you enjoy the show.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to the, this is the Wednesday edition of the Georgene Rice Show. James Blend is engineering and producing today's program. Today we'll talk with Jay Stringer. He is a therapist and a pastor. His latest book, his first book, in fact, Unwanted, How Sexual Brokenness Reveals Our Way to Healing. We're also going to talk with Dr. John Dybin. He's an addiction expert. We're going to talk about, or I should mention with the Origins Recovery Centers, we're going to talk about the growing danger of fentanyl in a new report that was released just days ago. We'll talk with Gina Halleck, legal counsel with Alliance Defending Freedom, where she's a member of the Center for Scholarly and Cultural Engagement, about a challenge in New York to a Christian adoption agency. Change your core values or stop functioning as an adoption agency. We'll tell you about the court challenge over that and much more today. Well, there's so much going on. It's been really quite difficult to keep up with it all. But some of the stories that we're developing today, neither President Trump nor the Democrats are backing down after the president threatened to shut down the government over border security funding in an on-camera clash with Democrat leaders Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi yesterday. And former Trump attorney Michael Cohen was sentenced today for tax evasion, making illegal hush money payments and lying to Congress about the president's business dealings before he was president. I should say candidate Trump's business dealings. Attorney for former Trump National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, attorneys plural, have asked that he receive probation and community service for lying to federal investigators in the Russia probe, making comparisons to the Hillary Clinton investigation, which was an investigation light. And Google CEO Sundar Pichai said the company has no plans to launch a project in China and fired back at allegations of anti-conservative bias in a House hearing on Tuesday. Five people have been arrested in connection with a manhunt for gunmen who killed three people and wounded 11 in Strasbourg, France on Tuesday. The suspected gunman was still on the run. And a magnitude 4.4 earthquake rocked Tennessee earlier today, or I should say Wednesday, and it could be felt in Atlanta, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. Well, in the wake of the unexpected, dramatic on-camera dust-up between the president and Democratic leaders in the Oval Office, top Republicans are rallying behind the president's call for funding a southern border wall, even if it could mean closing the government just days before Christmas. If we don't have border security, we'll shut down the government, the president told Schumer and Pelosi in that tense White House photo op. Afterward, Pelosi reportedly mocked the president in a private meeting on Capitol Hill with fellow Democrats, making a personal comment about his manhood. In a deliberate show of support for the president following the nationally televised showdown, House Republican leaders are considering sending a bill that would provide $5 billion in funding for the wall to the floor for a vote. A senior House GOP aide separately told Fox News that Republicans are confident the measure would pass, which would force Schumer and Senate Democrats to either approve the funding or risk being blamed for any ensuing government shutdown. The question is, which side will blink first? I don't know about you, but I get a little tired of these games of chicken that is politics in the 21st century. Lawyers for former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn argued Tuesday that their client deserved to receive no more than a year of probation and 200 hours of community service for making false statements to federal investigators in a document filed in federal court in Washington. His attorney said their client's cooperation with Special Counsel Robert Mueller's team was not grudging or delayed, but preceded his guilty plea or any threatened indictment and began very shortly after he was first contacted for assistance by the special counsel's office. Prosecutors working for Mueller said last week that Flynn had offered substantial assistance in several ongoing investigations and was entitled to avoid prison when he is sentenced next week. And speaking in front of House Judiciary Committee members who seemed a bit puzzled about what Google was in the first place. Amid allegations of anti-conservative bias and privacy violations on the platform, Google CEO Sundar Pichai said the company had no plans to launch that search engine in China. He responded to the question by U.S. Representative Sheila Jackson Lee when she said she was concerned about the company's controversial Project Dragonfly and asked what the company is doing to minimize the efforts. China was just one of the key issues Pichai was forced to address. He disputed the notion that his company is biased against conservatives under questioning by lawmakers. And since he said it, it must not be so. And French authorities have detained five people in connection with a manhunt for the suspected extremist who fatally shot three and wounded 11 near a Christmas market in Strasbourg on Tuesday evening before fleeing the scene, according to reports. The gunman has been identified. He is believed to be injured, remains on the loose. The suspect is a 29-year-old who was on a watch list of potentially radicalized people, had convictions in France and Germany for crimes unrelated to terrorism, and served time in prison. French officials say authorities didn't name him publicly or provide further details until today. And that 4.4 magnitude earthquake was reported in Tennessee early Wednesday. The quake hit about 6 miles north of Decatur, according to U.S. Geological Survey. The shaking was felt by residents as far as Atlanta, about 162 miles south of the epicenter. The Center for Earthquake Research and Information reported that a 3.3 earthquake occurred near Decatur about 10 minutes after the initial 4.4 quake, and they are continuing to monitor the situation there. And on this day in 2000, George W. Bush becomes president-elect as a divided U.S. Supreme Court reverses a state court decision for recounts in Florida's contested election. And in 1997, Ilich Ramirez Sanchez, the international terrorist known as Carlos the Jackal, goes on trial in Paris on charges of killing two French investigators and a Lebanese national. He would be convicted and is serving a life prison sentence to this very day. Well, the wall could mean a shutdown of government, we overheard in the rather rancorous conversation yesterday. According to the story, top Republicans are backing the president. From the Wall Street Journal, who could not have been entertained by the spectacle of the U.S. president jousting over responsibility for government shutdowns with the villainous Senate minority leader, whether Mr. Trump was merely following his script or erupted at Mr. Schumer's goading, the president abruptly took political ownership of shutting down the government next week over funding for his border wall. "I am proud to shut down the government for border security," Chuck, the president said, adding with flourish, "I will take the mantle. I will be the one to shut it down." And Senator Tom Cotton, being interviewed by Hugh Hewitt, said, "Now is the time to have this debate. And I think we should fight very hard to secure our borders. This is a critical issue on which we all campaigned when we were elected to office. And Hugh, it's simply a fact that walls, fences, and physical barriers do work. If they didn't, you wouldn't have all these rich politicians living in gated communities. We wouldn't have a fence around the White House. We wouldn't have armed guards standing at the doors of the Capitol. Physical barriers work, and they'll work at the border." Well, we'll see what happens in the days ahead as this conversation, this debate heats up. Now, we need to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about Michael Cohen, former Trump attorney. He gets 3 years in prison for tax fraud, campaign finance violations, and lying, a lot less than most people thought he would. Many of his offenses had nothing to do with his work with candidate or private citizen Trump. But we'll tell you what was said and how Lanny Davis, who was a fixer for the Clintons, spoke about a fixer for Trump and how he might be useful until March when he actually goes to prison. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
20 minutes after 4 o'clock, you're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Coming up later this hour, we'll talk with Jay Stringer. He's the author of Unwanted, How Sexual Brokenness Reveals Our Way to Healing. It might seem contradictory, but we're going to talk with him about it. Jay Stringer is a licensed mental health counselor and ordained minister. He lives in Seattle with his wife and two children. We'll talk about his first book, Unwanted, later this hour. Well, Michael Cohen, the president's former fixer, who once famously claimed that he would be willing to take a bullet for Donald Trump before later turning against his boss, was sentenced to 3 years in prison today, or rather Wednesday. Today is Wednesday. I keep thinking it's later in the week, by a federal judge in New York after pleading guilty to numerous crimes while cooperating with prosecutors. Before sentencing, he ripped into his former boss in federal court, telling the judge he felt it was his duty to cover up the president's dirty deeds. He didn't make mention of his own, which were unrelated to his service to the president, but that's another story. Cohen appeared before U.S. District Judge William Pauley III for sentencing after pleading guilty to campaign finance violations, tax evasion, and lying to Congress about the president's past business dealings in Russia. He was seen entering the Manhattan courthouse accompanied by members of his family. Speaking in court before the judge issued that sentence, Cohen said blind loyalty to Trump led him to take a path of darkness instead of light. He doesn't have to report to prison until March the 6th. He also was ordered to pay $1.4 million in restitution and a $50,000 fine and forfeit $500,000. A contrite Cohen, speaking in court, told the judge he takes full responsibility for each act, saying the sooner I am sentenced, the sooner I can return to my family. The sentence, while not maximum, signifies a remarkable fall from the hard-charging lawyer who for years was part of Trump's inner circle. The charges against Cohen arose from two separate investigations, one by federal prosecutors in New York and the other by special counsel Robert Mueller. Now, both cases hold potential implications for the president. His admission in the former to breaking the law and making hush money payments during the 2016 campaign to two women who claimed affairs with the candidate has raised questions about whether prosecutors may eventually pursue charges against the president. Cohen said he did so at Trump's direction. Sentencing memos filed last week show that he also told investigators about more Russia contacts that could fuel the collusion aspect of Mueller's probe. Lawyers for Cohen, who worked as Trump's counselors before the presidential campaign, advocated for him on television during the presidential race and remained his personal lawyer at the beginning of the administration, had asked for leniency because of his cooperation with both the Office of Special Counsel Mueller and prosecutors looking into campaign finance violations. But on Friday, federal prosecutors recommended a substantial term of imprisonment for Cohen, saying that his efforts to cooperate with Mueller have been overstated. Federal prosecutors said that Cohen was motivated by personal greed and repeatedly used his power and influence for deceptive ends, both in the service to Donald Trump and in his own service. Among other charges, Cohen recently pled guilty to misleading Congress about his work on a proposal to build a Trump skyscraper in Moscow, hiding the fact that he continued to speak with Russian about the proposal well into the presidential campaign. In the New York case, prosecutors accused Cohen of a years-long tax evasion scheme to avoid paying federal income tax on more than $4 million of his own money made through a number of ventures, including through his ownership of taxi medallions, his selling of real estate in Florida, and his consulting work for other clients. How this will relate to the Mueller investigation and collusion remains to be seen at this point. Three people have come forward with hundreds of pages of evidence of potential wrongdoing by the Clinton Foundation, including misappropriation of funds and allegations of quid pro quo promises made to donors during Hillary Clinton's tenure as Secretary of State. Representative Mark Meadows said on Thursday, and that's last. Meadows, the leader of the conservative House Freedom Caucus, is also the chairman of the House Oversight Committee, subcommittee on government operations. The panel is set to hold an investigative hearing on the status of the Foundation case. U.S. Attorney General, Attorney John Huber was tasked with investigating the foundation last year by then Attorney General Jeff Sessions. And at least for now, that probe is continuing. But for now, as we know, the leadership will change hands in the House after the holidays. And the Trump administration formally asked the Supreme Court in an emergency appeal to block a nationwide ban on the administration's new asylum policy that was unilaterally instituted by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals judge last month. In a November news conference, days before the midterm elections, the president had vowed to turn away all asylum seekers who attempted to cross the border illegally instead of properly presenting themselves at ports of entry. The president, who has long said the asylum process is rife with fraud, said the emergency policy was necessary as the leading Central American migrant caravan approached the United States border with Mexico. However, U.S. District Judge John Tigar, who was nominated by President Obama in 2012 to the District Court for the Northern District of California, issued a temporary restraining order 2 weeks later that brought a halt to that plan. Last week, a separate federal appeals court in San Francisco said the White House ban was inconsistent with the federal law and represented an attempted end run around Congress. But the Trump administration said in court papers filed Tuesday that the nationwide order preventing the policy from taking effect is deeply flawed and should be lifted pending an appeal that could reach the high court. We're being told that some 3,000 have flooded across the border since the back and forth has taken place. Two groups of Central American migrants made separate marches on the United States consulate in Tijuana yesterday, demanding that they be processed through the asylum system more quickly and in greater numbers, that deportations be halted, and that President Trump either let them into the country or pay $50,000 each in reparations for them to go home. On the one-month anniversary of their arrival in Tijuana, caravan members are pressing the United States to take action, but they're dwindling in numbers since more than 6,000 first arrived in the city's shelters. Approximately 700 have voluntarily returned to their country of origin. 300 have been deported. 2,500 have applied for humanitarian visas in Mexico, according to a caravan member who met with Mexican officials on Tuesday. The group of unaccounted migrants, about 3,500, are presumed to have either crossed illegally into the United States, moved to other Mexican border cities, or simply fallen through the cracks. Mexico's National Institution for Migration did not respond to a request to verify those numbers. The first group demanding action, numbering about 100, arrived at the United States consulate at about 11 a.m. on Tuesday. The migrants said they were asking that the Trump administration pay them $50,000 each or allow them into the country. When asked how the group came up with $50,000, the organizer from Honduras said they chose that number as a group. It may seem like a lot of money to you, he says, but it is a small sum compared to everything the United States has stolen from Honduras. Well, the Supreme Court on Monday missed an opportunity to bring clarity to an area of the law about which the lower courts are divided, whether states can prevent Medicaid funds from going to pay for non-abortion services at Planned Parenthood clinics. Justice Clarence Thomas dissented from the court's decision not to take up the case, joined by Justices Samuel Alito and Neil Gorsuch. Thomas's suggestion that the other justices' refusal to do their job here has something to do with the fact that some respondents in these cases are named Planned Parenthood. Justice Brett Kavanaugh did not join the dissenters, but that does not mean he or the other justices, for that matter, agree with the arguments made by Planned Parenthood and the other respondents. Well, Thomas highlighted that too often, the fact that abortion is involved in a case causes some members of the court to cast aside traditional legal and constitutional principles. This abortion distortion has led the court to twist free speech principles and undermine states' common sense health and safety standards to rule in favor of the abortion industry. Now the court has ducked the responsibility to clarify something about which the lower courts are in disarray. Does federal law allow individual Medicaid recipients to sue over states' Medicaid provider decisions? Well, these cases are about much more than abortion, as Thomas pointed out. Around 70 million Americans are on Medicaid. If the majority of the courts of appeals are correct, then Medicaid patients could sue when, for example, a state removes their doctor as a Medicaid provider or inadequately reimburses their provider. He continued, under the current majority rule, a state faces the threat of federal lawsuit whenever it changes providers of Medicaid, or rather medical products or services for its Medicaid recipients. It may even enable Medicaid recipients to challenge the failure to list particular providers. It's unmistakable that abortion looms in the background of these cases arising out of Kansas and Louisiana following the release of videos that raised disturbing allegations of Planned Parenthood profiting from the sale of organs from aborted babies, and charges of fraudulent billing practices. Several states, including Kansas and Louisiana, sought to cancel their agreements with the abortion giant. A missed opportunity, but the decision has now been made. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Up next, we'll talk with Jay Stringer. His book is titled Unwanted: How Sexual Brokenness Reveals Our Way to Healing. A mature subject. Our younger listeners may want to be diverted elsewhere. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
36 minutes after 4 o'clock, you're listening to the Georgene Rice Show. Well, there are sexual scandals abounding these days. You find them in the daily headlines. Pornography has become mainstream. Extramarital affairs, sexting amongst teens and young adults, girls involved in prostitution at younger and younger ages. Unwanted sexual behavior is at a crisis level. My next guest asks the question and answers it in his latest book, What's Driving It All? And Is There Any Hope for Healing? Well, in one of the most comprehensive research projects on unwanted sexual behavior to date, Jay Stringer, a licensed mental health counselor, ordained minister, and nationally requested speaker, surveyed nearly 3,800 women and men who sought out guidance in the midst of their sexual brokenness. And he shares the surprising results in his book, Unwanted, How Sexual Brokenness Reveals Our Way to Healing. He spent years listening to and helping clients work through unwanted sexual behavior and became intrigued by the common threads in their stories. He set out to learn more about what drives this behavior, why people paradoxically stay in a place of shame, and the journey toward a new sexual story. In the book Unwanted, he dives deep into the results of the study. He offers personal stories from survey respondents and encourages those who are walking similar paths. Well, Jay Stringer is a licensed mental health counselor, ordained minister, speaker on the subject of unwanted sexual behavior. Based in Seattle, he has spent the last decade on the front lines of demand for sexual exploitation and pornography. He works with men and women to find freedom from unwanted sexual behavior through guiding them to identify the unique reasons that bring them to it. He also is a lecturer for the City of Seattle's John School, a program designed for men who've been arrested for soliciting prostitution. He holds an MDiv and master's in counseling psychology from Seattle School of Theology and Psychology and received postgraduate training under Dr. Patrick Carnes and Dr. Dan Allender while serving as a senior fellow at the Allender Center. Again, he joins us today to talk about his book, Unwanted, How Sexual Brokenness Reveals Our Way to Healing. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Georgine. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Well, let's begin by defining sexual brokenness. What does that mean?
Yeah, so in my book, I use this phrase called unwanted sexual behavior. And essentially, that is any dimension of our sexual life that at the end of the day, we wish was not true. So that could meet the criteria of sex addiction. But for a lot of people, they have some element of their sexual life that could be the use of pornography, the pursuit of an affair or the fantasy of an affair, buying sex, that at the end of the day, they really wish was not part of their life. And so that was really the focus of the research and the book was, what's the why behind these unwanted sexual behaviors that all of us participate in?
Now, why do you think unwanted sexual behavior has risen to a crisis level?
That's a great question. I think that there's a number of ways to understand that. We know that the rates of pornography use have just skyrocketed. Porn is now one of the best metrics of cultural attention that we have, meaning that if you want to know basically what anyone is doing around the country, you can actually look at specific porn sites to see is porn below average in that area? Has it skyrocketed? So one example of this was back in the 2017 NBA Finals between the Cleveland Cavaliers and the Golden State Warriors. Porn was down around 6-8% in the Cleveland area. And then the moment that Cleveland was going to lose Game 5 and therefore the NBA Finals, porn use escalated by about 34%. And so I think that that's just part of what all of this crisis level of unwanted sexual behavior is revealing to us is that in the midst of our boredom, in the midst of our loneliness, in the midst of our anger, so much of what we are choosing to do is to outsource this to sexual brokenness. And that could be porn or infidelity or buying sex.
Yeah, not to mention the access that we now have. You don't even necessarily have to pursue pornography, for example, on your own. It will pursue and find you. It's quite amazing.
So well said.
Yeah, it used to be that you'd have to, hide a magazine under a mattress. Today, that's no longer the case, and it's been normalized.
Yeah, as many of my clients have said, I used to work really hard to try and find it, and now I have to work really hard to stay away from it.
Hmm. What role has the Me Too movement played in at least bringing to the surface the challenge that individuals face who struggle with sexual brokenness and addressing it in a meaningful way?
Yeah, so one of the things that I'm so encouraged by within the Me Too movement is that it is bringing to light one of those areas of sexual brokenness that the church has historically not been willing or able to address. And so most of the time when you engage men, especially on some of their sexual brokenness, the language that they use, they might say, I was really lonely, or I felt kind of abandoned, or I was just having one of those lustcapades. And what is consistently missing is that there's actually a type of entitlement, and there's a type of anger and a misuse of power with regard to much of our male sexuality. So a classic example of this in my clinical practice is a man might make a bid to his spouse for sex, and in being declined intimacy, he doesn't know how to regulate that disappointment. They don't know how to work through that conflict. And so what ends up happening, you know, half hour later, the next day, is that he's on some porn site. And, you know, if we typically just say, you know, he was just struggling with lust, but if we miss anger, we actually can't transform that dimension of our life. And so I think part of what Me Too is revealing is that issues of the misuse of sexuality are so much greater than just some benign struggle with lust.
You've spent many years counseling people who struggle with unwanted sexual behavior. And by that, I assume we mean people who are struggling in an area that they would just prefer not to have a struggle in, and found some common threads in their stories. Can you talk a little bit about that and the large study that you engaged in? And it really is the fodder for this book to help us better understand the challenge.
Sure. So as you mentioned, as a therapist, men and women were arriving in my office with almost no understanding of what freedom from sexual brokenness actually involves. So one of my clients recently said to me, he said, Jay, when I've been having the same conversation with my accountability partner for about 20 years, something isn't working. And so what's often been prescribed for people that are struggling is to get into some type of accountability group. Maybe get monitoring on your internet devices if you continue to struggle. And so part of what I began to see was that this wasn't still addressing what are the unique reasons that are bringing people to their problem in the first place. And so that's where I partnered with a couple national and international organizations to ask people to tell us a little bit about their story, to tell us about their childhood, to tell us about some of the formative experiences that they went through, to tell us some of the difficulties that they were facing in their present-day life, from a lack of purpose to depression to anxiety. And then one of the signature marks of this research study was that we actually asked people what they found arousing. So what were the specifics that they put on into the internet search bar? What were the fantasies that we're having? And what I can tell you is that what the data showed is that our sexual brokenness and the specifics of what we find arousing are actually not random at all. They were a direct reflection of the parts of our story that remained unaddressed. And so the implication that I'm bringing in Unwanted and a new course that I created is that if we want to find freedom, we need to identify the unique reasons that bring us to it in the first place. And to me, this is one of the most faithful approaches to Scripture and to the human heart, is that when I see God interacting with, let's say, Adam in the Old Testament, God comes to Adam and asks a question, which is, Adam, where are you? And we see this again with Hagar, who's just been immensely traumatized by the first family of our faith. The angel of the Lord appears to her out in the wilderness, out in a place where she's surely going to die. And the angel of the Lord says, Hagar, where do you come from and where are you going? And so one of the things that I'm trying to do within sexual brokenness, specifically within Christianity, is to really invite people to study and to be curious about their sexual brokenness. Mm. Sexual brokenness is often one of those areas that is so just slimed with shame. And so part of what my challenge is if you actually took one evening of curiosity to begin to question, how is it that this sexual fantasy keeps coming to my mind throughout the decades? Why is it that this specific pornography search appeals to me? I think part of what we'll find is that those areas of sexual brokenness have so much to teach us. And the reality is that God is not ashamed nor surprised of the things that we participate in, but actually understands our brokenness to be the very stage through which the work of redemption can be played out in our life.
Now, I need to take a break, but I want to continue this conversation. Again, we're talking with Jay Stringer. His book is titled Unwanted, How Sexual Brokenness Reveals Our Way to Healing. It explains the subtitle of the book. And again, we'll continue our conversation in a moment.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
51 minutes after 4 o'clock, you're listening to the Georgene Rice Show. Continuing my conversation with Jay Stringer, his book is titled Unwanted, How Sexual Brokenness Reveals Our Way to Healing. Mr. Stringer is a licensed mental health counselor, ordained minister, and national speaker. His first book, Unwanted, is based on a multi-year research project into the stories of 3,800 men and women to address the key drivers of unwanted sexual behavior, why people paradoxically stay in a place of shame, and the journey toward a new sexual history. His research is one of the most comprehensive studies on the subject. Now, it seems to me what you described just before the break is our tendency to want to paper over the story behind the story that might help us better understand how we find ourselves in a place that we would rather not be.
Yes. So much of what we have been trained to do with sexual brokenness is basically to hide it. So one of the things that we consistently get wrong, especially in the sexual integrity conversation, is integrity is all about being honest. And so if we want to see, as Romans 12:2 says, do not be conformed to the ways of the world in sexual brokenness, but be transformed by the renewing of our mind. In order to renew our sexual mind, we need to be honest about it at some point in our life. And so part of what the research found was that right in the middle of the very behavior that most people want to stop are actually the first set of clues into the freedom that they're seeking. And so what this book shows is that our sexual brokenness is actually not a life sentence to sexual sin, but it can actually be the roadmap to transformation that we've been waiting for.
Mm. You write about how evangelicals or believers, we tend to do what you describe as lust management. We deal with the result, the consequence, but not necessarily the thing that lay behind it. What's a better approach, particularly in the church, for dealing with a habitual sin that the person engaged in it wants desperately to be able to be free from?
Yes. So one of the things that I explore in my book is this concept of what does it mean for us to listen to our lust? And so what that is all about is this moment of curiosity where we begin to understand and question, why is it that this specific sexual brokenness has been the thing that has been appealing to me, that I've been seduced by for such a long time? So most of us, what happens is that we develop some type of self-contempt or self-hatred for our sexual struggles, and therefore we bury them. And buried underneath the ground, they can't grow, they can't mature, because we've just consigned them to something that is useless. And yet, most of what we come to understand with regard to emotions and fantasies in general is that if you want something to mature, if you want something to grow, it's really important to take a moment or two with a therapist, with a good friend, to really begin to consider, how is it that this fantasy, that this sexual brokenness, that this emotion has become such a central part of my life? And so one example of this would just be, if you take something as simple as anxiety, Most of us have been trained to basically outsource our anxiety. So I feel anxious, and therefore I go to a beer, a gin and tonic, I take a pill to begin to address that. But it's another thing altogether to be able to say, I wonder what this anxiety is actually getting at. Mm-hmm. And what does it mean for to listen to my anxiety, to say that maybe it has clues to tell me about the type of life that I've come from and how I've had so little support and understanding of how to work with my emotions. And so that's what I'm trying to invite the reader to, is to really say, what is it that you uniquely sexually struggle with, and could it be that those things actually provide clues? So One example of this is men and women in my research who had the highest rates of pornography use were actually 24% more likely to have higher sexual abuse scores than those that did not. And so oftentimes what happens is that our sexual brokenness will often get all the attention, and we spend a lifetime praying for the grace and forgiveness to do away with that. But part of what that sexual brokenness is trying to invite us to is to say, maybe there's some brokenness and some pain in our past that if we could actually go back and heal some of that, then this brokenness wouldn't continue to be part of our life. Another example of this is that men in my research who struggled with a lack of purpose, meaning they didn't like their jobs, they felt like a lot of the work that they did was meaningless, they were 7 times more likely to use pornography than those who had a baseline level of satisfaction with their life. And so that, to me, is just really good indication of our sexual brokenness has so much to teach us if we're willing to listen to it.
Mm-hmm. Now, once you've discovered some of the key drivers of unwanted sexual behavior, what's the best approach? Do you need to talk with a professional, a pastor? Can you deal with this on your own? What do you suggest once there's a better, or at least a beginning of an understanding of what lay behind the thing we're trying to jettison?
Yep. So I think relationships are really key here. So most of what my research found was that 59% of people that were struggling with unwanted sexual behavior did not feel like they had someone to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens within a lot of addiction and a lot of just unwanted sexual behavior is that shame begins to define us. And if we think that there's something really broken about us, we're not just pursuing an escape to unwanted sexual behavior, we're actually pursuing a behavior that's going to reinforce that judgment. And so part of why relationships are so key is that we get to begin to tell other people where we have harbored shame for a really long time. And when we begin to turn and face our shame, we actually disempower it. So I think one of the first things that we need to do is to come out of the shadows and invite someone else to know what we've been struggling with for a really long time.
That's such great advice. I wish we had more time, but I want to make sure that we talk about the third part of your book in which you talk about transformation. That's the part of the story that I think many doubt. Is it possible to eventually experience freedom from sexual brokenness and that freedom from an addiction or an attraction or a behavior? Talk a little bit about that transformation that is possible.
Sure. I unbelievably believe that transformation is possible. What I think we have to come back to is God is not just after conformity in our sexual life. He's up to radical transformation in our lives. And part of what happens when we begin to kind of peel back some of the layers of our sexual brokenness is that we're going to discover things about us that are really going to surprise us about who we are. And so I think part of this journey is that sexual brokenness and sin is so often the doorway into the wider work of the gospel to bring about this healing that we have longed for. And so in addition to this book, one of the things that I really wanted to do with my team was to equip the church, to equip accountability partners and those who are struggling in the shadows that don't with resources to really help them understand how does your story shape your sexual life. And so the book Unwanted, we also have a course called The Heart of Man Journey And that's www.heartofmanjourney.com. And that course is all about what does it mean to actually understand your story and to write a new one for your life. And so that's what we were really passionate about from this outset is there's lust management is not working. And so part of what we need to do to change this conversation is to invite people to see that right in the middle of their sexual brokenness, it's not a barrier to transformation. It's actually the very bridge that they've been waiting for to pursue the life that they so desperately want.
Well, I regret that our conversation is so brief because there's so much wisdom and guidance in the book. I would recommend that it be a part of the church library, and the course that you described could certainly help churches deal with not just lust management, but to go a bit deeper. Again, the book is titled Unwanted, How Sexual Brokenness Reveals Our Way to Healing. Jay Stringer, thank you so much for talking with us tonight.
Georgine, such a pleasure.
Appreciate it very much.
Thank you again.
And again, Jay is a national speaker. You might want to check him out as well. He is in the Seattle area. We've got news and traffic coming up at the top of the hour. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Welcome to the second hour of The Georgine Rice Show. Glad to have you with us. In this hour, we will talk with Dr. John Dybin. He's an addiction expert with the Origins Recovery Centers. We're going to talk about the growing danger of fentanyl. What is it, after all, and why is it as bad as it is? We're also going to talk with Gina Halleck. She's a legal counsel with Alliance Defending Freedom, where she is a member of the Center for Scholarly and Cultural Engagement. New York is challenging a Christian adoption agency, threatening them, saying if you don't change your core values, you won't be able to do adoptions in New York. We'll tell you more about that and the challenge that has been posed against the state of New York. Well, a federal judge issued a permanent order on Tuesday blocking the government from enforcing the Obama-era contraceptive mandate, which had forced religious groups to provide birth control to their employees despite their religious objections. Judge Philip Bremer, a judge for the U.S. District Court for the District of Colorado, wrote that compliance with the mandate violated the plaintiff's rights under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which we talked about earlier this week. Judge Bremer's order brings an end to an over four-year-long legal battle that began when these religious groups sued the Obama administration over that mandate. The six groups in the suit are the Association of Christian Schools International, Samaritan Ministries International, Taylor University, Indiana Wesleyan University, Asbury Theological Seminary, and the Alliance Defending Freedom. Again, that federal judge issuing a permanent injunction. And another federal judge ruled on Monday that Americans have a right to secrecy, or rather to secretly record their public officials, including police, when they're engaged in their government duties. U.S. District Chief Judge Patty Saris said Massachusetts law banning secret recordings violates the First Amendment. When it comes to government employees, rejecting the state's claim that officials need some space to be able to operate without having to worry about being monitored. This is not to say that police and government officials have no privacy interests, she wrote. However, the diminished privacy interests of government officials performing their duties in public must be balanced by the First Amendment interest of news gathering and information dissemination. She ruled in favor of two sets of plaintiffs, one of which regularly live streamed video of police officers performing their duties, and the other, James O'Keefe, whose Project Veritas specializes in catching public policy figures saying embarrassing things, sometimes illegal things. Mr. O'Keefe called the ruling groundbreaking, saying the impact of this win will ripple throughout the nation. It will set historical precedent and keep citizen journalism alive in all 50 states. And an email to supporters touting the case asking for money because he predicted Massachusetts would appeal that ruling. The state attorney general's office did not immediately respond to a request for comment or to questions about whether or not they would challenge that decision. Massachusetts law enacted in 1968 is a general ban on taping wire or oral communications with the legislature, saying it was concerned that the proliferation of modern electronic surveillance devices was a danger to citizens' privacy. Well, Judge Saris, a Clinton appointee to the federal bench, said those privacy rights are important, but said that must take a back seat when it comes to public officials and even police officers on duty. She said the First Amendment's protections are particularly important with respect to law enforcement officials who are granted so much discretion in depriving individuals of their liberties. The plaintiffs who shot video of police have never been charged with violations of the law, but said they had refrained from some recordings for fear of running into trouble. Likewise, a Project Veritas action witness said they wished to secretly record a whole bunch of people, but wouldn't do so in Massachusetts because, well, we can't. It's against the law, and we don't break the law. Well, the judge said the exchange showed unmistakable evidence the state law chilled the plaintiffs from exercising the right of free speech. And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said the U.S. Senate will take up a criminal justice reform bill backed by the president. McConnell said in his speech, it's likely the Senate will work between Christmas and New Year, if necessary, in order to pass criminal justice reform legislation before 2019. The Senate will now take on the bipartisan bill called the First Step Act after pressure from the White House and other members of the Senate who've been pushing for the legislation to be passed. At the request of the president and following improvements to the legislation that's been secured by several members, the Senate will take up the recently revised criminal justice bill this month. I intend to turn to the new text as early as the end of this week. So as a result of this additional legislative business, members should now be prepared to work between Christmas and New Year's, if necessary, in order to complete our work, McConnell said in his floor speech on Tuesday. Let me say that again. Unless we approach all this work in a highly collaborative, productive way and take real advantage of unanimous consent to expedite proceedings, it is virtually certain that the Senate will need to be in session between Christmas and New Year in order to complete this work. He continued, well, the president has endorsed the bill, which includes both prison and sentencing reforms, and wants to pass the legislation before Democrats take control of the House on the 3rd of January. Utah Republican Senator Mike Lee, who's been a strong advocate for First Step Act, sent out his praise in a tweet shortly after the news broke, saying, we're so close to delivering these meaningful reforms. Let's get this done. And it seems at this point that Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is determined to do just that. Well, House Democrats could announce as early as, tomorrow, that they've reached a deal that would limit Representative Nancy Pelosi to a term of 4 years if she's elected Speaker in January, according to reports. In exchange, a group of Democrats who have publicly opposed Pelosi's bid to reclaim the position she held from 2007 to 2011 would vote in support of the lawmaker from San Francisco. The exact number of Democrats who would change their votes was unclear. It's pretty much done, one source told Politico. The issue is, how do we wrap this up? What are the procedural steps that we need to get this done? On the 28th of November, 203 House Democrats formally nominated Pelosi as their choice for the job, but 32 Democrats did not support her. When the full House votes on the 3rd of January, the new House, Pelosi will need 218 votes to win the Speaker's role if all House members vote. Whether additional Democrats joining the fold would put her January vote total over the top remains unclear. At least five anti-Pelosi Democrats have confirmed they will switch their vote, according to CBS News. They are Representatives Ed Perlmutter and Linda Sanchez, both of California, Bill Foster of Illinois, Fileman Vella of Texas, and Seth Moulton of Massachusetts. But Politico repeated that at least three Democrats have opposed a term limit plan. They include Representatives Frank Pallone of New Jersey, Maxine Waters of California, David Scott of Georgia. January 3rd will tell the tale, and whether or not an agreement has been struck or an announcement made will tell us what to anticipate moving forward. Well, Time magazine has lost relevance in the United States and globally. The only thing that it's now known for is its Person of the Year issue, the 2018 edition of which is out. Historically, its editors have chosen the person or thing that had the greatest impact on the news, for good or for ill, guidelines that leave them no choice but to select a newsworthy, not necessarily praiseworthy, cover subject. If only that ambiguous sentiment had determined this year's choice, killed and imprisoned journalists. The magazine calls them the guardians, who were chosen for taking great risks in pursuit of greater truth, for the imperfect but essential quest for facts, for speaking up and for speaking out. Leaving aside the question of what exactly is the difference between speaking up and speaking out, further proof, if it were needed, of the detrimental impact of a massive wave of editorial layoffs at the magazine, we can all agree that a number of the journalists highlighted on the four different covers of the latest issue fall into the for good category. They include Maria Ressa, the editor of a Philippine news website, critical of the country's leadership, and Reuters journalists Hua Lone and Kwe So Oh, who were imprisoned in Myanmar for their coverage of the massacre of Rohingya Muslims. However, by an objective measure, murdered Saudi political dissident and Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi should have fallen into the for ill side of that equation. According to John Bradley, he points out his career as a journalist, such as it is, was anything but praiseworthy. Especially troubling is that if he hadn't been killed, it's likely that none of the others would have made it onto Time's cover. His death, Time tells us, laid bare the true nature of a smiling prince, the utter absence of morality in the Saudi-U.S. alliance, and in the cascade of news feeds and alerts, posts and shares and likes, the centrality of the question Khashoggi was killed over. Whom do you trust to tell the story? Let's remember that before he fled to the U.S. a year before, he was cruelly murdered in Istanbul. Khashoggi became rich working for a Saudi royal family that was and remains among the world's worst persecutors of journalists. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Up next, John Dybin, a doctor and an addiction expert.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Well, good afternoon and welcome back. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show, brought to you in part today by Zero Res. We all know that there is an opioid crisis in our country, and we've just learned that fentanyl is now the most commonly used drug involved in drug overdoses, according to a new government report. The latest numbers from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's National Center for Health Statistics says that the rate of drug overdoses involving the synthetic opioid skyrocketed by about 113% each year from 2013 through 2016. According to Wednesday's report, which analyzed death certificates for drug overdose deaths between 2011 and 2016, fentanyl was involved in nearly 29% of all overdose deaths in 2016. In 2011, it was involved in just 4%, giving you some perspective. Well, here to talk with us about what to do about this epidemic is Dr. John Dybin. He's an addiction expert with Origins Recovery Centers. To talk about the growing dangers of fentanyl. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for talking about this. It's important.
Well, it is important, and I think people are overwhelmed at the prospect of it. Can you describe for us what fentanyl is and how it's become sort of the number one drug of choice and how dangerous it is?
Well, and part of it is that, unfortunately, many of these deaths are not from people choosing to use fentanyl, but fentanyl is being cut or combined with other drugs, and so people are ingesting it and not even knowing about it and understanding what fentanyl is. So fentanyl is about 50 times more powerful than heroin, and there's a derivative of fentanyl called carfentanil, which is 100 times more powerful than fentanyl that's out on the street. So this carfentanil is actually an elephant tranquilizer. So a tiny, tiny amount, we're talking just like a few grains of sand, are enough to kill a person. And it can even be, it's so potent that, you know, first responders and such, when they're doing searches, if they don't wear gloves and it comes into contact with their skin, just small amounts, they can overdose on it. And what's happening is a huge amount, and it really originated in China. Huge amounts came in through China, but they've come through other places. It's less expensive it's cheap to make. It takes a small amount, and what's happening is people have begun putting it into and cutting it with other drugs. So someone might take heroin, that we're finding it in benzodiazepines like Xanax. They're finding it even cut in marijuana, and small, tiny, tiny amounts are enough to kill someone. And so we're seeing it. We don't know exactly who's putting it into the other drugs. But again, if you're talking about drug dealers and manufacturers, you're not talking about people of the highest ethics. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of carfentanil and fentanyl deaths that we're seeing, people aren't even trying to use fentanyl. They're using other drugs that are cut with fentanyl, and it's so powerful that it's killing them.
How addictive is it? And as you mentioned, it's often used with other things. Is fentanyl in and of itself addictive, or is it in combination with other things that we see it contributing to addiction?
In and of itself, it is an opiate. So it's an opioid. It's in the same category as heroin. So what it does is we know that heroin and other opiates and opioids, that type of drug, they bond with a very specific type of receptor in the brain, and they cause pleasure, but they also cause, in a certain percentage of people, they cause the brain to actually, the entire functioning of the brain to change, and we call this addiction, and it's a disease because it's a changed brain state. And it's the same reaction, it's just that fentanyl is far, far, far more powerful than heroin. Interestingly enough, so is OxyContin. OxyContin is not nearly, it's a common opiate that people get for pain. What they don't realize is that the brain, the human brain, does not know if the drug you're putting into it, what its name is. It doesn't know if it was you got it from a doctor or from a street dealer. It only knows that you've put this certain type of drug into it. So whether it's heroin, fentanyl, or a prescribed opioid, any of these things, people can and do become addicted to them.
Mm. Josh Bloom, who is a senior director of chemical and pharmaceutical research at the American Council on Science and Health, said there's never been a drug like fentanyl before. For street drugs, this absolutely destroys anything else in terms of lethality and danger. And CIA Director Michael Morell calls fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. It's out there. I'm not sure what efforts are being made to prevent it from making its way onto the streets. But what can be done from your perspective, first of all, in making it available and appealing? But secondly, if a person does find that they are addicted, what's the answer for those who are using it?
If you find yourself, if you or a loved one is addicted, and this is critical, you have a healthcare emergency. If you or a loved one found out that you had cancer, you wouldn't say, oh, I just need to tough it out. You'd get professional help. We know this. Treatment works. I personally see it every single day. I see people who are horribly addicted and whose lives are being destroyed by it get treatment. The first thing people have to know is if you or a loved one is addicted, you have a healthcare emergency, and just like you would seek an oncologist for cancer, you have to seek out addictions professionals, physicians who are addictionologists, therapists who are experts in addiction, because recovery is possible. And the other part of that is that when somebody gets treatment, treatment is also prevention. So if I'm a 10-year-old kid and my parents are addicted to opiates, and my story ends up being that they died of opiate addiction, then guess what? The likelihood that I'm going to enter into a life of drugs is actually higher. But if I'm that 10-year-old kid and my parents are opiate addicted, but they get treatment, they get help, they get sober, and my story is about restoration of my parents to me, then you have made it less likely than I'll ever use it in the future. So the keys for people to know are if you have or a loved one has addiction, that you must treat it as the health emergency that it is.
My guess is that not all recovery centers are created equal. What should you look for? What are some of the priorities when you're dealing with someone who has a chemical in the system that requires that chemical being replaced on a regular basis, known as addiction? What should you look for?
So in treatment, first of all, especially with opioid treatment, and there are many different options, and I come from a bias. I believe that people can be free of drugs. And there are two kind of camps. There's one that says the solution to opiate addiction is just keep someone physically dependent on a different drug that they will stay on for either forever or for a long length of time, and this drug will help them not want other drugs that are more likely to harm them. That's one camp. I come from a camp that I strongly believe that people can be free of drugs, but it requires a multifaceted approach. And so if I'm looking for treatment, first of all, there has to be medical professionals. This is a medical condition, so I have to, the process of detoxification, of coming off the drugs, needs to be handled by medical professionals. So, and also, addiction does a lot of damage to the body. So if I'm looking for treatment, I'm looking for a place that has a strong medical component. Then I'm looking for a place that, what happens when I get rid of the drugs is I have people who are addicted to drugs, when they come off of them, they have a sense of disconnect, a hole in the soul. And so I come from a perspective where I believe that a spiritually focused, and I don't mean religiously, but I mean a program that deals with reconnecting to life, reconnecting to something bigger than myself. And then finally, it has a psychological component. It messes with our minds. And so I'm always going to look for a program that has a strong clinical psychology-driven program. So body, mind, spirit. Addiction affects all those things, and so treatment must directly address them as well.
Well, Dr. Dybin, thank you so much for talking with us. I should mention that he is an addiction expert with the Origins Recovery Centers. This is a growing problem, and finding resources to help is always in order. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. We'll be back in a moment to talk with Gina Halleck, legal counsel with Alliance Defending Freedom, where she's a member of the Center for Scholarly and Cultural Engagement. We'll talk about a New York challenge to a Christian adoption agency. Change your worldview or stop. We'll be back.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Well, good afternoon and welcome back. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. Alliance Defending Freedom attorneys have asked a federal court, this was last week, to stop Albany officials from targeting a faith-based adoption provider because of its religious beliefs. New Hope Family Services, they're facing the interruption of adoption placements and the immediate phase-out of their adoption program if the religious nonprofit doesn't immediately change its policy, prioritizing the placement of children it serves in homes with a married mother and father. Well, here to talk with us about this appeal is Gina Halleck. She's legal counsel with Alliance Defending Freedom, where she is a member of the Center for Scholarly and Cultural Engagement. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, let's put this into some perspective. Is this adoption agency the only agency in the New York area so that it's impossible for others with different points of views to find an agency to work with them?
There are approximately 130 agencies operating throughout the state of New York, including 58 state-run agencies that are located in every county. And the vast majority of those agencies, all 130 of them, are willing to place with any individual or couple that qualifies.
New Hope has been doing this work for over 50 years. And they placed about 1,000 children, if I understand correctly, with families. Their core philosophy is that every child deserves to grow up in a household with a mother, a father. They work with the adoptive parents to place that child. What's the objection from New York?
Yeah, you're right. New Hope has placed over 1,000 children. Their objective really is to live out their faith by providing an arms around the shoulder approach to birth mothers who are dealing with the challenges of unplanned pregnancies, and also to adoptive families who are, you know, wanting to take children into their home. And so New Hope has operated since 1965 consistent with its religious beliefs about the nature of marriage and family. They are willing to place with single individuals because their religious beliefs aren't implicated in the same way in that context, but they're unwilling to place with unmarried couples or with same-sex couples. And basically here, the state on its own initiative during a normal audit learned of its religious beliefs and issued an ultimatum that if they're not willing to violate those convictions, that they will have to shut down their program.
Now, one would assume that if New York is overseeing or is intervening here, that the agency is probably receiving some public money, giving New York the authority to then dictate their core values. My understanding, however, is that this adoption agency, New Hope Family Services, doesn't receive any public money at all.
That's right. New Hope intentionally does not receive any public money, has no public contracts, and it's really done that in order to ensure its autonomy and ability to operate consistent with its faith. In fact, in limited circumstances, New Hope will place a child in a foster care with a foster care family, and when it does that, it pays for that child's placement on its own through private grants or donations that are given from individuals to the ministry. So it has no public funding that's involved here whatsoever.
So what standing does New York then have to now impose its worldview on this private agency that's been functioning in the state for many, many years successfully?
Well, New York has a regulation that's on the books since 2013, and that's the regulation that the agency is relying on here. In 2010, the legislature expressly permitted unmarried couples and same-sex couples to adopt. But at the time that the governor signed that into law, he noted that this was not going to infringe on anyone's religious beliefs and that agencies would be able to continue operating. So we're hopeful that you know, the governor's understanding of the law and also the Constitution will prevail here. Every American has the right to live according to their religious beliefs, and adoption providers are no different.
Mm. Well, one of the things that I appreciated was said by one of your associates is that adoption providers exist to help children, not to affirm the desires of adults. And this seems to seek to impose an adult perspective on a practice that has a direct impact on children and their birth parents, whether that's a mother or mother and father, attempting to place their children in a home that reflects their values as well.
Yeah, that's really the tragedy here. We live in a pluralistic society, and there's no reason that we should be singling out and punishing those who hold the belief that the best home for a child includes a married mother and a father. And unfortunately, it's the children who are going to be suffering in this situation. More adoption nonprofits mean that more children will be able to find loving homes, and that's really what we should be focused on.
Now, as I mentioned at the top of our conversation, Alliance Defending Freedom attorneys have asked a federal court to stop Albany officials from targeting the faith-based adoption agency. What can you tell us about the federal court, and what are the prospects that you're going to get a favorable ruling in this case? And if not, what next?
Well, just today we filed a motion seeking sort of immediate relief. Basically, we're asking the court to allow New Hope to continue operating while the lawsuit moves forward. And so I don't have a timeline on that, but we're hopeful that we'll be successful in that regard.
I think it's important to emphasize that this is not just a case involving New York, involving officials in Albany, and one organization, New Hope Family Services, but it has implications that reach far beyond this particular case to other agencies as well who hold a traditional biblical view of marriage and family, who function without government funding to serve the needs of others who share those same core values. How significant do you think this will ultimately be to other agencies across the country who fear that they too might be singled out because of their Christian worldview?
We've definitely seen this issue popping up in several states, and honestly, this is one of the first cases of its kind where there's no government contract involved, no public funding involved, and a faith-based agency is being shut down purely because of its desire to place with mainly married couples. This will have far-reaching implications. We're hopeful that we'll get a great ruling here that will protect religious freedom, not just for this agency, but for other agencies, mm-hmm. and also protect the religious freedom of us all.
Yeah. Now, I think it's important to point out that New Hope serves all clients, and they do refer unmarried couples or same-sex couples, to other adoption providers that share their worldview. So accommodation has been made for those who have a different view on the subject of adoption.
Yes, that's a great point. Also, New Hope operates as a pregnancy resource center as well. And through its pregnancy resource center, it provides medical referrals, education, counseling, and tangible resources to all families that are raising children. And that includes individuals who are either unmarried couples, and or those who identify as gay, lesbian, transgender or bisexual. So New Hope really loves and serves all members of the community in many ways. And as you mentioned, they do refer individuals that they're not able to work with for adoption placement to the other 130 agencies throughout the state of New York.
What do you anticipate in terms of timing? The letter was submitted last week. You communicated again this week. How soon do you expect to hear something on whether or not the agency can continue to function while this suit makes its way through the federal court?
We're hopeful that we'll know something on that front within the next couple of months.
Okay. Well, we'll certainly continue to follow the story, and I appreciate once again the work of Alliance Defending Freedom that is helping New Hope to challenge the intrusion on the part of the state of New York through Albany officials, and we'll certainly be in touch to follow what happens next.
Well, thank you so much for your interest and for following up with us. And if your listeners would like to hear more, they can find out more at adflegal.org.
Hey, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Again, Gina Halleck is legal counsel with Alliance Defending Freedom, where she's a member of the Center for Scholarly and Cultural Engagement. Diversity and tolerance have been redefined to the point where they don't actually apply in the real world. We all must think the same. We all must do the same thing. We cannot tolerate any difference of opinion or worldview or priority. And the First Amendment notwithstanding, the freedom of religion is no longer looked upon as a carve-out for those who have sincerely held religious beliefs. So we're going to continue to follow this case. And again, if you'd like to do so and follow other cases that Alliance Defending Freedom are involved in, you can go to adflegal.org. I also wanted to point it out that in the Supreme Court's decision establishing same-sex marriage in Obergefell, Justice Kennedy wrote that reasonable and sincere people believe in good faith that marriage is the union of a man and a woman, suggesting that that is tolerable even under the Supreme Court's ruling. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. We'll be back in just a few moments.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back. This is the final segment of The Georgene Rice Show. Wanted to give you an update on the Marines that were missing after a mishap in the air. The five Marines from that aviation mishap have been declared dead. This is off the coast of Japan. These members of warplanes that crashed off the coast of Japan last week have been declared dead, and the search for them has ended. The U.S. Marines made the announcement late Monday. One Marine was rescued late Wednesday, and the body of another was found. The planes, an F-A-18 jet and a refueling plane that had taken off from the base in Okinawa for a regularly scheduled training mission, crashed last week off Japan's coast. The crash is the latest in recent series of accidents involving the U.S. military deployed to or near Japan. Last month, the U.S. Navy FA-18 Hornet from the aircraft carrier USS Ronald Reagan crashed into the sea southwest of Japan's southern island of Okinawa, though its two pilots were rescued safely. And in mid-October, the MH-60 Seahawk, also belonging to the Ronald Reagan, crashed off the Philippine Sea shortly after takeoff, causing non-fatal injuries to a dozen sailors in that incident. But these five have been declared dead, and the search has come to an end, again changing this season for their families. Well, there's a very cool doubleheader in outer space this week. In addition to the flyby of Comet 46P Wirtanen over the weekend, the often spectacular Geminid meteor shower is going to also make its annual appearance, and that's coming Thursday night. I mention it today because tomorrow I'm celebrating the 88th birthday of my mother, and I think this meteor shower is probably in her honor. With hundreds of meteors streaking across the night sky, this one in particular is often the best meteor shower of the year. The reliable Geminid shower counts as one of the year's best, peppering the night sky with about 15 to 120 meteors per hour at its peak. That's according to earthsky.org. More good news, the crescent moon will set at about 10:30 p.m., leaving the rest of the night moon free. Astronomy.com says observers under the sky's dark sky can expect to see an average of 2 per minute, even though there are many more to be seen in a darker location. The Geminids are named for the constellation Gemini, the point from which the meteors seem to radiate. To be more specific, the meteors will appear to emanate from a spot in the sky near the bright star Castor or in Gemini. Well, this meteor shower is active every December when Earth passes through a massive trail of dust debris shed by a weird rocky object named 3200 Phaethon, according to NASA, or it might be Patheon. I'm not quite sure how they would pronounce it. But the dust and grit burn up, and when they run into the Earth's atmosphere in a flurry of shooting stars, it's quite a sight to see. Well, the nature is of this display is somewhat debated. It's either a near-Earth asteroid or an extinct comet, sometimes called a rock comet, according to NASA, not entirely clear. But the Geminid meteors are bright. They're fast, 79,000 miles per hour, and the shower is famous for producing fireballs, which are meteors that are brighter than magnitude minus 4, the same magnitude as the planet Venus. So according to Sky and Telescope, the Geminids are only behind August's Perseids. When it comes to fireballs, meteor showers don't require binoculars or telescopes to view, just your bare eyes and some patience. Well, a lot of patience. To increase the chances of seeing meteors, choose a site at least 40 miles from a major city. Astronomy.com says, suggesting gear includes a lawn chair, lots of warm clothing, blankets, cookies or fruit, and a warm non-alcoholic beverage. By the way, alcohol interferes with the eye's dark adaptation as well as the visual perception of events. So if you have consumed alcohol, you're less likely to enjoy the show. The cold is always a factor with the Geminids. If you're willing to brave a long lookout of possible sub-freezing temperatures, you're going to be amply rewarded, we're told. The best viewing weather on Thursday night is expected across the central part of the United States, while the eastern half of the country and the northwest will see mostly cloudy skies. No big announcement there. The Geminids were first noted as a minor meteor shower back in 1862. At the time of the Civil War, the shower's peak was at 30 meteors an hour. Since then, they've gradually strengthened to become the strongest annual shower. Bill Cook says, he's a NASA astronomer, this is due to Jupiter's gravity nudging the stream closer to Earth. So that's coming up Thursday night. And when you see that meteor shower, think of Lillian Rose, who was born on that day back in 1930. We'll be celebrating her 88th birthday tomorrow. Not quite sure what we're going to do, but we're going to do whatever an 88-year-old wants to do. So we're going to have some fun with my mom on that day. It's also the 24th anniversary of our kidney surgery. In fact, I went with her earlier this week to see her kidney doctor, and all reports are that she's doing great. I'm so proud of her. I can remember the day or days following the surgery. We were about to go home, and she and I shared a room. Throughout our recovery time, we were about to go home, and they went through the laundry list of things that she would need to do to protect her kidney. And they literally had her sign a contract saying, yes, I fully intend to keep this commitment because this is a valuable procedure. I don't want to squander the gift that I've been given. And she was a real trooper in doing literally everything that she was required to do, which included something like 50 pills a day that she had to swallow to help avoid rejection. And she has done extremely well. As I mentioned, she's going to be 88 tomorrow. This is the 24th year since the surgery, and I'm so proud of her and grateful for the years that we have enjoyed as a consequence of her taking care of her health. So I'll say it publicly today, but certainly to her tomorrow, happy birthday, Lillian Rose. I am so honored to be your daughter, and it's been a joy to be raised by you and to follow your example these 62 years that God has given me. And I aspire to be more and more like you because you're more and more like Jesus. I just love that my mother loves God's word. She spends time in it every day. She recognizes her need of a Savior and is counseled and taught by his word. And sometimes when I go down into her apartment, for those of you who don't know, she lives with my husband and me and has her own private apartment at our home. Sometimes the first thing she says is some excitement that she has found in studying God's word, something she perhaps didn't discover was there, but some new meaning, some new facet of the word that she has discovered in a new way. And even at 88, she gets excited about that. So I aspire to be like her because, quite frankly, my mom is like Jesus, and I'm seeing her character being transformed even in these latter years. So I'm grateful for her. On Saturday, we have established an annual high tea for my mom and the few of her peers that are still with us. And so we serve them tea. My sister and I, we dress in formal teaware as servers. We don't participate in the tea. We are simply there to serve them. And it's such a delight. We close the door and give them their privacy to overhear the peals of laughter in the room. And you can hear them reminiscing about memories that they have shared. One of my, she's really a cousin, but I've always referred to her as my aunt. She's 94. My mother and she are the oldest left of my immediate family on her side, really on either side of my family. And then there are a couple of others. And to hear them just reflect back on their childhood and growing up and talking about their faith and what God is teaching them, it's just such a delight. And again, I aspire to be like them. So on Saturday, we're going to have a high tea for them and looking forward to that. And then on Sunday is our famous Rice family Christmas, where members of my husband's extended family, there are very few of them still in the Portland metro area. But this year, for the first time since we established this tradition, his brother who lives in Las Vegas is going to be joining us along with his wife. They're going to be joining us for Rice family Christmas on Sunday. So when I return to the mic on Monday, I'll probably be exhausted, but just delighted and joyful at this opportunity we'll have to spend time with family. But anyway, I just want to remind you that on Thursday, you'll be hearing the best of the Georgine Rice Show as I'll be hanging out with my mom. And then on Friday, we'll be back in studio for a bit of a fun Friday fair. I should also let you know that next Friday, we're going to revive the Rice Family Christmas radio program, and Dan Rice will join me in studio, and we'll bring you the 2018 version of the same. So I hope you'll plan to join with us. That's the last Friday before Christmas. All right. I want to thank James Blind for producing and engineering today's program, and thank you for making the Georgine Rice Show part of your day. Have a great night.
Thanks for listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. If you'd like to download a podcast of the show or would like more information on today's guests, please visit the show at kpdq.com or on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at GRice Show and like us on Facebook. And join us live every weekday at 4 for more critical thinking for critical times on 93.9 KPDQ.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.